All right, good morning, everybody. We are in Joshua chapter 12, and we're just in the, we're pivoting from the conquest narratives to the inheritance. All right, so from once we get past chapter 12, the rest of the book, by and large, is about detailing what land goes to which tribe. So we'll be, I think we'll be moving through that pretty quickly. There will be a few episodes over the course of that where certain pieces of land need to be conquered or reconquered before they get settled, particularly some land that that Caleb of Caleb and Joshua fame has to go in and reconquer. So interesting little story, and it's one that gets repeated again in Judges, if I remember right. Let's go to Joshua chapter 12, and we're going to start, let's just do the first six verses here. Now these are the kings of the land whom the people of Israel defeated and took possession of their land beyond the Jordan toward the sunrise, from the valley of the Arnon to Mount Hermon, with all the Araba eastward. Sihon, king of the Amorites, who lived at Heshbon and ruled from Aroer, which is on the edge of the valley of Arnon, and from the middle of the valley as far as the river Jabbok, the boundary of the Ammonites, that is, half of Gilead, and the Araba to the sea of Kinneroth eastward, in the direction of Beth Geshemot, the sea of the Araba, the Salt Sea, southward to the foot of the slopes of Pisgah. And Og, the king of Bashan, one of the remnant of the Rephaim, who lived in Ashtaroth and at Edrei, and ruled over Mount Hermon and Seleka and all Bashan to the boundary of the Geshurites and the Maakathites, and over half of Gilead to the boundary of Sihon, king of Heshbon. Moses, the servant of the Lord, the people of Israel defeated them. And Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave their land for a possession to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh. All right, so this first little bit of chapter 12, we can see that the text is taking us way back. All right, the text is going back in history because we are going to get a summary, a brief summary, of the entire conquest. So it doesn't just cover Joshua's conquest. We've gotten a little bit of a summary of that already. We're going to get some more. But it also covers Moses' conquest. And so the text is going to center us on this association between Moses and Joshua. There's really not much to say about this passage in particular, other than, again, it's just describing this land that is to the east of the Jordan, that the tribe of Gad, the tribe of Reuben, and the half-tribe of Manasseh are going to inherit. It talks about a conquest that we've already seen, the conquest of Sihon and the conquest of Og. The most interesting thing to note about Og, the king of Bashan, is what the text tells us in verse 4, that he was one of the remnant of the Rephaim, who lived at Ashtaroth and at Edrei. Being one of the Rephaim would make him more or less related to some of the giants of the Philistines, right? Some of the Anakim that we've read about in earlier chapters. Right? His identity as Rephaim means he would have been a very large guy and would have been a very strong warrior in his own sense. And so this, by the way, what a wonderful name for a big, beefy guy, Og. That is what you name your beefy son. So, Moses has conquered them. Let's go ahead and continue. We're gonna include the rest of the chapter in this as well and start drawing out some bigger points about what the chapter is doing. And then we'll take questions and comments. So verse 7. These are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the people of Israel defeated on the west side of the Jordan, from Baal-gad in the valley of Lebanon to Mount Halak that rises towards Seir, And Joshua gave their land to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to their allotments. In the hill country, in the lowland, in the Arava, in the slopes, in the wilderness, and in the Negev, the land of the Hittites, the Amorites, the Canaanites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The king of Jericho, one. The king of Ai, which is beside Bethel, one. The king of Jerusalem, one. The king of Hebron, one. The king of Yarmut, one. The king of Lachish, one. The king of Eglon, one. The king of Gezer, one. The king of Debir, one. The king of Gedar, one. The king of Horma, one. The king of Arad, one. The king of Livna, one. The king of Adullam, one. The king of Makeda, one. The king of Bethel, one. The king of Tapua, one. The king of Hefer, one. The king of Aphek, one. The king of Lasharon, one. The king of Madon, one. The king of Hazor, one. The king of Shimron Meron, one. The king of Akshbath, one. The king of Taanach, one. The king of Megiddo, one. The king of Kadesh, one. The king of Jokneam in Carmel, one. The king of Dor in Napath Dor, one. The king of Goyim in Galilee, one. The king of Tirzah, one. In all, 31 kings. Okay. So, and you could get, this is one of those interesting passages where you can kind of get the sense of, like, the Hebrew cadence for things, because it definitely comes across in English. I want us to notice, though, what the chapter in total is doing here. It opened by telling us the names of the kings. Right now, these are the kings of the land whom the people of Israel defeated and took possession of their land. Right, so it starts off with these two kings being named, Sihon and Og. And then that little bit of the passage in verse 6 ends this way. Moses, the servant of the Lord, and the people of Israel defeated them. And Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave their land for a possession to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Right, so the attention then shifts to naming Moses. In fact, it's interesting. The text goes for 5 verses talking about this conquest on the east side of the river without even naming Moses. Right now, we as readers know it was Moses, but it waits to name Moses until the very end. And then tells us that Moses did that work for the inheritance of Israel. All right, so Moses defeated them and gave their land as an inheritance or for a possession to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Then you look in verse 7. These are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the people of Israel defeated on the west side of the Jordan from Baalgad in the valley of Lebanon to Mount Halak that rises towards Seir. And Joshua gave their land to the tribes of Israel as a possession according to their allotments. Right, so right off the bat, Joshua is named, and the purpose of his work is also named, that he is giving this land as a possession to Israel. And it's only after that point that we get the names of all of the cities of these kings. It's interesting, we don't get the names of the kings. We just get a count of the kings. So you've got the king of each city, and they're counted up, a total of 31 kings. Excuse me. All right, so what this does, again, is it emphasizes this association between what Moses did and what Joshua is doing. It focuses on the purpose of what they are doing. They are giving Israel a possession. They're giving Israel their inheritance. So the text is connecting Joshua's leadership to Moses' leadership and shows that Joshua has indeed been a worthy successor to Moses. unfair. That was one of the big questions that we asked, I guess, kind of early on. Right? We said that that was going to be the question of the book. Is Joshua going to be a worthy successor to Moses? And we've shown throughout Joshua's obedience. But here, the text, again, brings it back pretty explicitly to show us that Joshua is a worthy successor to Moses. This connection between their two works is also going to carry us into chapter 13 as we begin to see the land being given to Israel as an inheritance. The inheritance itself is going to go through the same pattern. Chapter 13 is going to start with the territory east of the Jordan, the inheritance that Moses gave to Israel, and then after that, it's going to move over to the west side of the Jordan and the inheritance that Joshua gave Israel. So again, this is the conquering and the giving of the promised land is presented as a two-part work. It's not just Joshua conquering the land, but it's Joshua and Moses. The chapter also emphasizes, you know, the totality of the conquest. I know as we go through, and especially that second section, again, as we kind of get into that repetitive mode where we get in that cadence, you know, the king of X won, the king of Y won, the king of B won, it can be easy to kind of zone out. I suspect this is something that would have kept the attention of the Hebrew mind better than the attention of the English mind. But what this list does is shows us the totality of the conquest. You start with this move from Moses to Joshua, which is the move from east to west. Right? So if you look at Moses' conquest, it moves on the east side of the Jordan from south to north. You've got all of this territory taken, starting here, sweeping up. And then from Joshua, by moving from Moses to Joshua, that moves us from east to west. And the conquest of Joshua likewise makes this movement from south to north. Right? The summary, if I remember right, moves in the... Yeah. It moves, I think, from north to south, if I remember correctly. So in verse 7, these are the kings of the land whom Joshua and the people of Israel defeated on the west side of the Jordan, from Baal-Gad in the valley of Lebanon. All right, so that would be in the north. To, Mount Halak that rises towards Seir, that's in the south. But then the summary that follows, right, from verse 9 through the end of the chapter, moves, roughly speaking, from south to north. You might recognize some of the names in verses 9 and following. So verse 9, we've got Jericho, we've got Ai. Verse 10, we've got Jerusalem, Hebron, Yarmut, Lachish, Eglon, Gezer, Debir. These are all cities that we have talked about already. A couple of verses later, Makeda. Remember, that was the cave where the southern kings were hiding out, and Joshua had them roll stones in front of the cave to trap them there. So all of these cities starting out with, these are cities that we've already heard named in the southern campaign that we read a few chapters ago. And then we get down to verse 19, right, with Hazor. Now remember, Hazor is the leader of the northern coalition. And then we get a bunch of place names from the northern part of the kingdom, including at least one place that you should recognize, the king of Goyim in Galilee, right? Galilee being up here. So the text, again, starts out on the east, has a sweep from south to north. Then it moves over to the west and has a sweep from south to north. And so the text, again, gives us this sense of the totality of the conquest. Excuse me. It also gives us maybe a bigger picture of Joshua's part of the conquest than what we had already seen up to this point. So we said that several of these city names are ones that we should recognize from earlier in the book. Some of them, though, have never been mentioned in the book up to this point. So even we recognize the name Galilee, right? But we've not heard the name Goyim in this book yet. And several of the cities that we have mentioned here in this list are not ones that we have seen before. Hey, we get a sense in this chapter, like we did in the montage at the end of chapter 11, that Joshua's conquest is really long and it covers a lot of territory that we just don't get the specifics of. We don't need the specifics of. So that is, we've basically read over the book's executive summary of itself. Right, this is, if you wanted to boil the book of Joshua down into just one chapter, it's this, chapter 12. The whole land is conquered, and it's given as an inheritance. Any questions or comments before we move on to chapter 13? Okay, so let's go into chapter 13. Like I said, I think from this point forward, we should be moving pretty quickly. Verse 1. Now Joshua was old and advanced in years. And the Lord said to him, "You are old and advanced in years, and there remains yet very much land to possess. This is the land that yet remains. All the regions of the Philistines and all those of the Geshurites, from the Shihor, which is east of Egypt, northward to the boundary of Ekron, is counted as Canaanite. There are five rulers of the Philistines, those of Gaza, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath, and Ekron, and those of the Avim in the south, all the land of the Canaanites, and Merah that belongs to the Sidonians, to Aphek, to the boundary of the Amorites, and the land of the Gebelites, all Lebanon toward the sunrise, from Baal-Gad below Mount Hermon to Lebo Hamat, all the inhabitants of the hill country from Lebanon to Misrephoth-Mayim, even all the Sidonians. I myself will drive them out from before the people of Israel. Only allot the land to Israel for an inheritance, as I have commanded you. Now therefore divide this land for an inheritance to the nine tribes and half the tribe of Manasseh." All right, so this transitions us into the inheritance of the land. But before we actually see any of the land parceled out as an inheritance, we're told that there is still a lot of land unconquered. Right? So in the last chapter, we got a sense of the totality of the conquest. In this chapter, we get a sense of how many holes there are in that. Mostly here along Israel's western coast. This would be most of the territory that's named, particularly belonging to the Philistines. But you also have some territory further down in the south, belonging to the Canaanites. You also have some territory far up in the north, territory belonging to, the Sidonians in particular are named. They inhabit this area up here. So there's quite a bit of land that Israel has not taken. Now, here's a question for you. Whose fault is it that Israel has not taken the land at this point? I mean, they're supposed to take all the land, right? They've not taken all the land.
Their own fault.
Okay. Now, where do we see that in the text? In Joshua 13. Right, because there are other places we could point to for that. What you're saying is true. We could point to places like Judges chapter 1. But here in what we've just read in Joshua 13, where do we find blame being laid against Israel for not having conquered the land? Well, do we see a place where God blames Joshua? All right, the whole thing. Well, go ahead. Well,
it's all, he's past in years, he's not able to
I don't think I've ever blamed anybody for being old before. Well, y'all would get mad at me. But here's... Yeah. Here's what's really going on. I ask y'all a trick question. I try not to do that. There's no blame laid in this passage. Now, again, and this is kind of the same thing that happened with the Gibeonites. Like, we come to the text with a set of expectations about the way God is supposed to act, and then he acts differently on us. Our expectation coming to this would be that, oh, of course, God's going to be mad that Israel's not conquered all the land, because he told them conquer all the land, and it's not all conquered yet. And yet, we do not find God being angry at anybody in this passage. Why is he talking to Joshua? He gives Joshua a commission in this passage. What is God's commission for Joshua in the passage that we just read? Parcel out the land. Yeah, give the land as an inheritance. In other words, he's not coming to lay any blame on Joshua. He's not coming to, to chew him out or anything. He is coming to give Joshua a new commission, which closes out his old commission. Joshua is not going to be doing any more conquering. Go ahead, John.
The key here is that I will drive them out. So God is going to go ahead and finish the task that Joshua did not complete, correct?
Yes.
And Joshua's job is going to be by casting lots to give the inheritance of the land to the
Yes. Yes. He's going to be, you could say, like supervising or overseeing this process of giving out the land. Because it's a pretty big process of naming the boundary markers and deciding, again, which tribe gets its allotment first and where that allotment is going to be. Casting the lots, making sure that the tribe is going to actually do what they're supposed to do. That's going to be his job. The job of conquest has been taken from him. And the Lord says that I myself will drive them out of the land. And so we still get this sense that Israel is in God's favor, right? Because God's not saying, all right, now Israel cannot stand before their enemies. We'll get that in Judges, right? Where they fail to conquer the land like they're supposed to. And so God comes to them and says, because you've disobeyed in this, now I'm going to give you over to your enemies. But here, that's not what we have. Here, it is simply Joshua has gotten old. And how has he gotten old? He's spent this whole time going out doing what the Lord has told him. Right? He's been living at war his entire life. So we start out with this notice that Joshua is old and advanced in years. This gives us a sense, by the way, of what the book meant back in chapter 11, verse 18. Joshua made war a long time with those kings. That was at the tail end of the northern campaign. And we get this kind of summary statement that Joshua, after that campaign, just goes on tour all over the Promised Land and is just conquering left, right, and center. And we're told that he made war a long time with those kings. Now, we still don't know exactly how many years it's been. I think we find that out later in the book, exactly how many years Joshua has spent doing this. We'll get some hints along the way. But we get at least some sense for it. At least that it was so long that at this point Joshua is now old. And this is to be expected, by the way. Remember, he is described as a capable warrior already in the book of Exodus. So, in fact, those conquests that are described as Moses' conquests over on the east side of the river, remember who Moses has command the army. It's Joshua. Right? He's already an effective warrior, and he's a leader of men already at that point. He's a leader and a warrior even earlier than that. In fact, he's described that way before the wilderness wandering. All right, and then obviously, how long does he spend wandering in the wilderness? 40 years, just like everybody else. So he's already a capable warrior. Then he spends another 40 years in the wilderness. And now he has been at war for a long time, so that he is old and advanced in years. So much so, have you ever felt so old and advanced in years that God himself comes to you and says, you're old and advanced in years? It cracks me up every time I read verse 1. Like, that's the kind of Hebrew repetition that just really cracks me up. Now, Joshua was old and advanced in years. So God came to him and said, you're old and advanced in years. Wonderful. John?
Not to get you off track, but how many miles of a journey would you assume that that is?
Ooh.
Yeah, a lot of maps have scales.
Yeah.
Anyone who's even just walked to the corner store and back realizes that that's a while. I mean, a safe number would have to be 300 miles, correct?
At least that. Off the top of my head, I am not sure. That's something I'll need to sit down and do some measuring and figure.
I mean, do you think they're doing it by foot? They got all these warriors with them, animals that they got to take care of.
Yeah.
This wasn't just a mile with that pack. Was not just an easy.
Yeah. Ride, you know? Yeah. And
it's mountainous terrain.
Yes. Yeah. Lots of different changes in the elevation of this terrain as we've gone through. Joshua has been up and down this region multiple times, just in the description that we've read in chapter 12. How many hundred miles that amounts to, I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Go ahead, John. Something that is of note today is verse 2. This is a land that yet remaineth all the borders of the Philistines.
Yes.
Even God understood how important it was to secure the borders. This is what they're battling still today, correct?
More or less. I mean, we can see some analogs between the modern day conflict over there and some of the ancient conflicts that we've seen in that region.
And even so much that's going on, say that these are important borders to secure. I'm going to go ahead and secure these for you so that exactly on the map would that be?
So, and I had meant to upload this to the website. I'll try to remember to do that once we get to Illinois. But just to give you a rough sense of kind of the shape of the land that has been conquered, you kind of have a blob that's almost hourglass shaped through here. But there's and this gets to what you were asking, on the edges is mainly where you have all of these pagan people still living. All up and down the coast. A lot in the hill country and the mountainous country up in the north. If I remember correctly, there's a bit of a pinch in the middle that kind of gives it a roughly hourglass kind of shape. Where, as we will read in the book of Judges once we get there, there's a lot of people kind of in the middle of Israel. A lot of areas where the Israelites are living practically next door to the inhabitants of the land and fail to drive them out. Is there a hand over here, Wayne?
I was taught that in the process of the promise, the fulfillment of the promises to Abraham, there's a scripture I don't know if it pops right off my head. Where in the reign of David, towards the end of his reign, when Solomon came in and took over,
yeah.
It says that they would.
Yes.
It lasts long, you know, because Solomon split the country after a while.
Right. Yes.
But there was a point here where all the land promised was completely and totally fulfilled. Now, I don't know if that's a lie or if it's just a
No, that's true. That's true.
That's an accurate statement.
Yeah, that's accurate.
They actually overcame Philistia.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So actually, you're making a connection here that's important for us to make, because, you know, we hear about a lot of this territory that we hear about not being conquered yet belongs to nations that we've heard about already. It belongs to the Canaanites. They've not all been driven out. But we also learn of a few other nations that still inhabit the land. And this is really one of the first times that we hear about one of the major threats to Israel, right? This is the first time that we hear about this people who will become a major threat to Israel, the Philistines. Now, of course, what time period do we normally associate the Philistines with? Like when we're thinking about Bible characters, who normally do we think of as fighting against the Philistines? David, and especially Saul before him, right? So we're talking about quite a ways into Israel's future here from the perspective of Joshua's time. The Philistines are still a problem. And it is, you know, once we get to it, we'll see. It is Saul's job, right? His commission from God is to destroy the Philistines. And he fails to do it. And so that job then falls on David. And it's not until the end of David's reign that he actually succeeds in doing it, right? He works at it all through his kingship, but it's not until close to the end that he actually accomplishes it. And it's really not until the reign of Solomon that we see Israel filling up the entire area that God had promised them. And even, I mean, depending on how you're looking at it, even possibly a little bit more. But then of course, the great tragedy of all of that is that what happens right after Solomon's reign? The kingdom splits. It falls apart. This is one of the great tragedies of Israel. It's like we see how obedient they are right here at the beginning. We've made a big, big emphasis on their obedience and Joshua's obedience. And no matter how obedient they were not yet able to conquer the entire promised land. Their obedience is not enough. Right? Then you move forward, and there's lots of fits and starts, lots of major hiccups, like the period of the judges, and the reign of Saul. And eventually you get another king, another ruler, who is, you know, he's not quite as faithful and obedient as, you know, on the level of Joshua. But David, of course, is a model of the faith. And he finally gets the kingdom unified, and it falls apart just like that. Right? The whole story of Israel is that their obedience to God is not enough. And that even just a little bit of disobedience can take everything that they have already built and make it fall completely apart. It's completely to dust. So, okay, that takes us kind of far and wide of where we are here in Joshua. But that gives you a sense of where we're going with the Israel story. All right, so we've got this focus now on the Philistines. Now, we've already heard a little bit about them in the conquest narrative at the end of Joshua chapter 11, where Joshua goes and he conquers the Anakim, these guys who are descended from the Nephilim, giants. And we're told that Joshua conquers all of the Anakim except for a few cities where he does not wipe them out. Among them, Gath, which of course is the home of Goliath. Right, most of the cities that get named there are Philistine cities. So those are on the horizon. So we'll just finish off by saying that Joshua's new commission here, again, the Lord's not laying any blame on Joshua for anything. Joshua's new commission, what he's going to spend the remainder of his life on, is dividing up the inheritance, which is where we will start next time that we're together in Joshua 13, verse 8. That's when we get down to the actual business of settling Israel into the promised land. Thank you so much for your kind attention this morning and your questions, comments, and Lord willing, see you in a couple of weeks.